From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, Exploring How Human Habits Work, the journalist Charles Duhigg says it's all about cues and rewards. The cue is like a trigger. Something gets you started, and then it becomes a routine. And then there's always some reward associated with it. And once that happens enough, cue, routine, reward, your brain goes on autopilot. Duhigg says this is why people sometimes don't remember actually driving to work. They know they just got there. That process has become automatic. Well, today in the program, we're talking about the habit of driving, which, of course, is the principal source of air pollution. So we're talking about how habits work, how they form, how you break them. We're asking, what is the thing that would make you change your driving habits? Is it about education? Do you need an incentive? Would it have to get personal? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Saturday, thousands of Utahns showed up on Capitol Hill for a demonstration about Utah's polluted air. In the crowd, you could see the signs identifying the culprits, industry and other businesses, passive state leaders, ambivalent citizens. And it's hard to say whether we've reached any kind of tipping point yet, but it does seem more and more Utahns are concerned about the air. And a conversation, of course, has begun about what has to change to deal with the problem. On this program, we've talked about the industry part. We've talked about the role of government. We'll continue, of course, to talk about all of that. But today, we're going to focus on another part of the equation, and that is those of us who drive, our part in the problem. There's some disputes about how the equation really works out, but it does seem clear overwhelmingly most of the pollution is coming from tailpipes. And most of us, whether out of necessity or convenience, have gotten into certain driving habits. So today in the program, we're going to start there with that habit part. We wanted to explore just what it would take to change our behavior, our habits. What's the point at which you ditch the car for the day or get a bike? What's the thing that would make the difference? Is it about education? Do you need an incentive, a nudge? Would it have to get personal? Joining us first on the program is Charles Duhigg, who is a New York Times staff writer, and he's the author of the book, The Power of Habit: Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, which is just out in paperback, in fact, this month. Charles Duhigg is joining us from his office in New York City. And Charles Duhigg, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I guess I wanted to begin with whether or not you think this idea of driving as a habit, does that plug into the way you've been thinking about this and writing about this? When we drive ourselves around, is that a habit that you think sort of qualifies in the way you've been thinking about it?
Absolutely. So a habit is a decision that our brain made at some point, or that we made at some point, that over time we continue doing without sort of actively making the decision anymore. And as you pointed out at the beginning of the program, what we've learned about habits in the last decade in particular is that there's a sort of three stages to it. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for a behavior to start, and then the behavior itself, and then finally a reward. And it's these cues and these rewards that are really important. So as people get into a pattern where they come to rely on driving for everything, you know, to sort of serve up these rewards that they need, such as buying food or getting to work or even just making sort of mundane tasks more convenient, it certainly becomes a habit. And in a sense, our brain sort of turns off when we decide to use the car instead of thinking about alternatives.
So it's interesting. What complicates the story is something you write about, is that essentially we'd go nuts without habits. I mean, this is something that our brain does to help us sort of order the universe, I guess, and help us
so we don't
go crazy.
Absolutely. And studies show that, in fact, there was one study at Duke University where they followed hundreds of people for over a year, and they found that about 40 to 45% of what people do every day is a habit, not really a decision, but just this automatic pattern. And when you think about it, if you had to decide how to get to work every single morning and it was a fresh decision and you couldn't rely on any of these patterns, it would be mind-numbing, right? It would be awful to have to make that decision every morning. So the fact that our brains can take these patterns and make them automatic, it frees up brain space to think about inventing fire or electricity or the aircraft carriers or what the memo we want to write that day or talk to our kids about what they're doing in school. It's really important.
Mm. One of the experiments that you write about in the book is one where these monkeys were put in front of these monitors, and they were to touch the colors that they got, that they saw on the monitor, and they would get this drop of blackberry juice. And what's interesting about that is over time, once they sort of developed the habit, the reward itself became less important than the activity itself. I mean, it wasn't really as much even about the blackberry juice. It was just about the act of doing it, it seemed.
That's exactly right. And there's this really interesting thing that this teaches us about what craving is when we talk about craving within our actual brains. When you think about it, all of us have had that experience where you have a big breakfast, you get to work, you're not hungry at all, and then you walk past the snack room and there's a box of donuts there, and suddenly you're craving a donut, right, despite the fact that you're not hungry. And the question becomes, why? Why does that happen? And what these experiments have shown is it happens because once your brain knows that something's going to deliver a reward, you begin anticipating that reward. And if that anticipation isn't satisfied, what happens in your brain is a neurological pattern that looks very similar to depression. So in other words, once we anticipate getting something, it's really, we have this huge craving for it, which raises this question, how do you short-circuit that? And the answer is sort of twofold. First of all, you can give yourself that reward, right? Or give yourself something that mimics that reward. So instead of eating a donut, perhaps, if you have an apple, because what you're really craving is just putting something in your mouth. Or maybe it's that you want something sweet, in which case you could have, you know, some Splenda and some coffee. Mm-hmm. Or the second thing is that, and this is kind of a unique capacity that humans have, we can oftentimes, if we recognize that craving, almost by recognizing it, talk ourselves out of it or come up with something alternative. And for transportation, this is a great example, right? Because very frequently when people think, oh, I've got to run down to the store and it'll just be so easy to jump in the car. In fact, we don't even think that, right? We just automatically assume we're going to drive. And we know neurologically there's this small craving of actually accomplishing this goal of getting to the store and picking up the milk that you need. But what we know is that if people recognize that craving and say, oh, you know, instead I'm going to ride my bike, or I'm going to wait until this evening and bundle a whole bunch of things together so that I don't have to drive twice, simply the act of recognizing the craving and kind of intellectually coming up with an alternative, that seems to offset the craving and make it less powerful.
So it seems like a big point here is becoming aware of all of this, that you have to be mindful is something that you write about a lot in the book. That, because you've talked about the fact that a lot of us, when we get in our cars, then we're all of a sudden at work, and we don't even remember that time between when we got in the car and, you know, it went on the exit and any of that stuff. It's because it's become automatic for us. And I guess the point is to become more mindful of the whole process, I guess.
Absolutely. In fact, there was a really interesting study that was done in the Netherlands where they were trying to encourage bike riding among a university population. And what they found was that if they put up reminders and they asked people to list all of the reasons why riding their bike was better than taking the bus or driving a car, that if they could interrupt that pattern at the start of it, that all of a sudden people started riding their bikes more. Right? And this makes a lot of sense because, you know, think about yourself. If before leaving the house, someone like one of your kids was to say to you, you know, wouldn't you be healthier if you rode your bike today, or wouldn't it be great if we could carpool with the neighbors? That interrupting that pattern, it's not as if we don't like carpooling or riding our bike. It's that we just get into a pattern and we do it unthinkingly. Mm. And so the key is, in many ways, to become cognizant of the cues and the rewards that are driving your behavior. That once you start paying attention to them, this kind of delicate power of a habit seems to lose some of its traction.
There's this section in the book where you write about crises that present opportunities to, you know, affect change. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. This is where sort of political and business leaders can come into play. What do you know about, what have you learned about how a crisis, and let's talk about an environmental crisis, which I would dare say a lot of Utahns would consider Utah's bad air sort of one of those crisis points for us. But what do we know about that and the way it affects the way we deal with, you know, the habits we've established?
Well, crises are really important because we know from studies that when we look at how organizations or societies or individuals change, that habits become much more flexible during a moment of crisis, or at least a perceived crisis.
Yeah.
Environmentally, one of the best examples of this is, for instance, the passage of the Clean Water Act, which occurred under President Nixon. And what was important is that in the months prior to the passage of the Clean Water Act, there was actually this lake that caught on fire. And this created headlines, right? It was Lake Erie. It's a well-known lake. There were so many pollutants in it that it actually caught on fire. And news magazines would have these photos of a burning lake. And this was a moment of crisis that kind of crystallized for everyone that there was a problem here, that patterns, societal habits had to change about what we were doing with our toxic waste. Because up till then, it was pretty accepted that if you had toxic waste, you could just dump it into a river, because that's what rivers did, right? They carried away our waste.
Yeah.
And Congress sort of seized onto this crisis as a moment to change this important law. Now, what's interesting is President Nixon actually vetoed the law the first time it passed,
right.
And Congress overrode his veto. And I think that what this points to is that when there are these moments of crisis, whether it be in someone's life or in the life of a city, they oftentimes serve as a way for us to crystallize and unify our desire for change. And it's that desire for change that really makes habits flexible, right? We begin talking about how change is possible, and it pulls these habits out of sort of those parts of our brain that are almost subconscious into the parts of our brain where we think and we make deliberate, rational choices. Now, the key here is, though, that the crisis really has to be explained and defined. There's numerous crises that happen all the time that no one's really aware of or you don't really think of as a crisis. It's not until someone or a group of people or a group of leaders say, this is a crisis moment, that all of a sudden people's attention gets focused on it and change becomes possible.
So this means that activists who are engaged in this issue, they're really crucial for the process. The idea of them sort of stirring things up, getting people to gather as they did on Saturday at the Capitol, that's a really crucial part of changing habits.
That's a crucial part of starting the change.
Starting the change, right.
But then the question becomes, so how does it spread, right?
Yeah. Well,
how? Because activists working alone are typically not enough to start a movement.
Right.
And the way that things end up snowballing in that everyone else gets involved, normal people who don't think of themselves as activists,
yeah,
become impassioned about an issue, is that oftentimes they get drawn in through social habits. A great example of this is the civil rights movement and the Montgomery bus boycott. No one really knew who Martin Luther King was before the Montgomery bus boycott, and he rose to prominence as a leader of it.
Right.
And for an entire year, the black citizens of Montgomery all boycotted the buses. Now, you can understand, and this was in response to Rosa Parks being arrested for sitting in the white section.
Yeah.
Now, you can understand people boycotting a bus for like a week or two, right?
Right.
But an entire year, people were trudging to work in cold weather as empty buses are passing them. The question is, why did that happen? And as researchers and historians have looked at it, what they found is that Montgomery had these social habits, right? Sometimes we call it peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you were the type of person who was willing to turn your back on your community and start riding a bus when everyone else was willing to stick with the cause, then the society would kind of not punish you, but definitely not make you feel good about that,
yeah,
right? And riding a bus is a really public thing. They can see you on the bus through the windows as you're going by. I think for cities like Utah, or Salt Lake City in Utah in general, this is actually kind of a valuable lesson because, you know, Salt Lake City and Utah have these strong communities, these strong groups, whether it be organizations of faith or organizations of community service. And there are social norms that are set by those organizations. And we know that the social norms, the peer pressure, the congratulations that we give other members of our community, that's how societies and cities develop habits, and those habits can be really powerful.
You write about, there's this interesting story you write about Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary. You talk about how when he was the head of this big aluminum company, Alcoa, most people know it, I'm sure, that in some ways he kind of transformed that company, not by dealing with all kinds of different habits, by picking one. And it seemed to have this kind of chain reaction. I wanted you to talk about that, because I thought that was an interesting part of how habits work.
Yeah, this is a concept that's known within the psychology literature as keystone habits. And what they seem to suggest is that some habits seem to have more power than others because they set off a chain reaction that change other patterns. At Alcoa, as you pointed out, which was an aluminum company, Paul O'Neill came in, and instead of talking about profits or productivity, he said his number one goal was to change habits around worker safety, that he wanted to get to a place where this company, no one was ever injured working for Alcoa. And Alcoa, you know, making aluminum is this really dangerous activity. It's the, you know, molten metal with electricity arcing over these powders and elements. And what's important about that is that when Paul O'Neill decided to focus on worker safety, what he really said is that he's focusing on a set of values for the company. That worker safety was so important, every person's life inside that company was so important, that they were going to do whatever it took to make sure that everyone left work as healthy and as safe as they came to work. And that really sent a message to the organization. It set off a chain reaction, actually, that began people to start thinking about their jobs differently. And it turns out the easiest way to make aluminum safely is to do everything by the book. And when you do everything by the book, you tend to actually make better aluminum, right? If you follow the rules, the aluminum that comes out looks pretty good. And so as a result, Paul O'Neill was able to change the entire culture of this organization by focusing on this one keystone habit. Now, the same thing happens in people's lives. There's these interesting studies about when people start exercising habitually, they tend to start eating better, which makes sense, right, because we sort of feel healthy. But people who start exercising habitually, they also, on average, use their credit cards less frequently. They do their dishes earlier in the day. And that's because when you start exercising, it changes how you think about yourself. For many people, exercise is a keystone habit. And it changes these other patterns without us really thinking about it.
One of the things you write about is that we need to kind of, you need a reward in order to change a habit. And I'm wondering, one thing to establish a habit is, I guess the question is, what kind of reward could we offer ourselves to establish a pattern away from driving everywhere?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first of which is that this social component is really important,
yeah,
right? So if people begin carpooling, if they begin riding the bus instead of driving themselves, others really need to congratulate them on that. We know that social reinforcement makes change easier. But the other part of it is to think about the rewards that you do get, and really accent those rewards. So carpooling is a great example. One of the things that they found is that when carpooling begins to spread through a community, it tends to, after it reaches a certain tipping point, spread pretty quickly. And that's because people begin to learn that they actually like carpooling, right? It's fun to be in the car and kind of talk to your neighbors or talk to your friends. San Francisco is a great example of this, where you find a culture of carpooling that's emerged because people frankly just enjoy being with other people. And it's important to accent that, to teach people and to remind people that there is this benefit from carpooling that they might enjoy through public, you know, campaigns or advertising. Equally, it's also really important to offer actual rewards. So one of the things that, for instance, London has done to reduce its traffic congestion is that they set up a system of taxation where if you drive into the central district of London, you have to pay very hard taxes. Those are essentially negative rewards, right? They're punishing you for driving too much. And so one of the things that they do is that when people who used to drive into the central district stopped driving in, London would send them letters telling them how much money they had saved in not paying those taxes over the past year. The point is that for a reward to really be rewarding, you have to realize, you have to recognize it's a reward. Someone has to point out to you, you should be enjoying this. You should feel good about yourself, or you should feel good that you saved this much money. And really drawing attention to those rewards, making them conscious, that has a huge effect on how we see things.
So government can, I mean, through those, so there are forces. The government can impose this reward system, and that they can work. I guess there has to be a sense of buy-in. I mean, I wonder if it, I mean, one of the things you hear about in the West, and, you know, the sort of the mythology of the West is that people love to drive, They like private property. They don't like being told what to do from government. Do you think all of those kinds of obstacles that probably exist everywhere in the West, I guess, can be overcome if you sort of figure out how it all works? And is there a workaround for some of those things, I guess?
Well, I think the most important thing is that you can't punish people for not driving, right? It really takes government activity because you have to have a viable alternative to driving. If you say to someone, we don't think you should drive your car, but you have to walk a mile and a half to the bus stop, or we're going to make life hard for you to not drive your car, then there's no reward for it. In fact, there's a punishment for it. If, on the other hand, you say, we're going to offer you a commuter tax advantage, the HOV lanes that are in some states, right, or some cities, where if you have two people in your car, you get to go in a special lane and you can go much faster because there's not as much traffic. Those are things that actually reward people for carpooling or for making different decisions. You know, and you'd asked, can the government do this? The government does it all the time. If you think about, for instance, the tax break that you get for interest on home ownership. The government decided that they wanted to encourage home ownership, so they changed the tax code to encourage it, and it was incredibly successful. Government policy can influence habits enormously. But the thing is that you need to really sit down and think about, what behaviors do I want to encourage and therefore reward? Are those rewards genuinely rewarding? Am I removing the barriers or the punishments for someone changing their behavior? And which behaviors do I want to discourage so I make them harder? That's why HOV lanes have been such a success in places like California, is because it's a genuine reward for having more than one person in your car.
Let's take a few calls before we get to a break. Krista is with us in Salt Lake City. Krista, hi.
Hi, Doug. How's you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I'm a committed environmental activist, and I've been car-free for about almost 9 years. And the way I did it was my car died, and I said, let me see how long I can go. And it's been a challenge, but I've been able to do it. And I'm a year-round bike commuter. Recently, I had surgery and had to borrow a car to get to work, and I had the car for a couple of days sitting outside my house. Well, I'm still committed to carpooling and taking the bus, but the car was sitting out there, and there were so many times I would look at it and say, you know, it would be so much more convenient if I just hopped in that car. It was so seductive. It was teasing me, saying, come take me, rather than, you know, doing the right thing. And I had to talk myself out of jumping in that car and driving it.
What's the reward now that you give yourself for not, you know, I mean, how do you think about it?
Well, I think about it as the fact that, you know, the air, we had the big rally on Saturday, and I think of how horrible the air is. And I'm thinking, you know, it's just not the right thing to do. I know that sometimes you have to have them, but I can't slip back into doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been times I thought, well, maybe I should just buy a car. And then I'm like, well, no, because I'm saving. The big thing for me is I'm saving a lot of money. I can afford to live by myself because I don't have a car. And that kind of keeps me going on it.
Glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
From our Facebook page, Natalie said, I moved closer to work, now only a 5-mile round trip. Bought a hybrid, drive only longer distances one time a week. Johnny says, the tipping point for me was when I found out my wife was pregnant. I don't want my kid to someday have to miss recess because of bad air, so I sold my truck, forcing myself to bike, commute pretty much everywhere. I also convinced my boss to let me work from home one day a week. Dennis says, focusing on individual responsibility misses the mark. The problem, he says, is systematic. We need more comprehensive and affordable public transportation. We need tighter regulations on corporate polluters, more regulations on vehicle emissions and infrastructure that discourages driving while being more friendly to pedestrians and to cyclists. Katie says we need to be smarter about how we use our cars. For example, she says dressing up for the cold weather instead of running the car in the driveway to warm it up, or leaving it idling in parking lots. Let kids walk to a friend's house, to the school, to the store. Plan your day or even your weeks. Our car trips are consolidated, she says. Just like so many things in life, we mistakenly believe that our little change really can't affect a greater one. Charles Duhigg is the author of the book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and in Business. It just came out in paperback, in fact, this month. He joined us from his office in New York City. Charles Duhigg, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue this conversation we've been having about Utah's really bad air. Now, we've talked about, we'll continue to talk about the role of industry and business in air pollution, but today we're trying to focus on your part, my part in the problem, and that is driving. If you're divvying up blame, you have to acknowledge that the largest proportion of the problem is those of us who do drive. It's cars and trucks. So we wanted to explore what it would take to change that behavior, that habit. What's the point at which you get rid of the car for the day, where you take public transportation? What's the thing that would make a difference for you? 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Judy Faze is joining us here in the studio, the newest member of the KUER news team. He reports on the environment, has been covering this issue for a long time now. Judy, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
Kate Lonis is communication manager for Salt Lake City's Division of Sustainability and Environment. They manage the city's environmental programs, including their efforts to reduce pollution. And Kate Lonis, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Judy, let me start with you. And I guess to the question we're trying to get at, and I wanted you to help me put it in perspective. I'm trying to figure out what if it makes sense to divvy up the problem. I mean, you hear people saying, really, industry's the problem. It's driving. I mean, does that matter? That the fact that most of the problem does come from a tailpipe. I mean, how do you have this conversation? Because you don't want to let industry off the hook, but it's difficult to talk about individual responsibility. I mean, how are you thinking about this more broadly, I guess?
Well, I guess my sense of things is that people want to know what they can do to have some control in their lives.
Yeah.
You have to breathe, and so you want more control over that. So I think to look at the various contributors to pollution, it's really important, because otherwise you can't figure out, well, what are the kinds of things that can happen to actually improve the air quality? What role can I play? What role can an industry play, for instance? I think that in the recent past, the thing that I see as the biggest hope for our air quality is the Tier 3 standards that the Obama administration announced some months back.
Yeah.
And I think they're supposed to be finalized next month. I don't want to minimize the fact that there are a lot of contributors, but as a single portion of the air quality solution, it seems like everyone I talk to say it's the biggest one single solution we can have. And basically what the Tier 3 solution is it will require refineries to lower the amount of sulfur in their gasoline. Utah refineries are actually a very very close to the mark where they need to be. So they're already using lower sulfur inputs and they're putting out lower sulfur fuel. And then the other component is that cars will be a lot cleaner too. So, you know, we make a lot of decisions about what we do every day. Most of us can't not drive, at least some of the time. Some people can. They live in town and they have access to good transit. But even the moms with small children who want to take transit, to ask them to bring their kids out and stand at a bus stop on a cold, smoggy day, I don't know if that's very realistic. The clean air, the Tier 3 standards, they say they're going to reduce the pollution in the gasoline by another 90%. They already did that with Tier 2 standards. And they're going to make cars and trucks more efficient or cleaner, I think by, they say, 80%.
Yeah.
And those standards will start going into place in 2017, and they're thinking most of the fleet's going to be turned over by 2025.
What part of do you figure, and Kate Lonis, I want to get you on this too. So we're getting better standards for cars because there's the reality that people drive them because of necessity or whatever it might be. But how much are you trying to, and Kate, I'll start with you on this one. How much are you trying to target people, you know, to trying to convince them to drive less? I mean, how much of that is part of the way you're thinking about that?
The city has spent actually a lot of effort over the last few years really trying to target our residents with that behavior change message. The Clear the Air Challenge, I think, is a great example of a program that does just that, encouraging people to take these active, positive steps to change their behavior and do what they can do. Like Judy was saying, not everybody can take public transit every day, but there are other things you can do. You can work from home or call in to a meeting instead. Be idle free, something as simple as that. And so the Idle Free program, Idle Free Schools, and our latest is actually our Smart Trips program, which is a neighborhood-based program that goes into a very specific, targeted neighborhood in Salt Lake City, gets to know that community, that neighborhood, the resources that are available there, and helps the residents access the bike infrastructure that is in their neighborhood, transit, helps them figure out how to route on transit.
Yeah. And which also, bus stop and all
exactly,
that.
Exactly. We actually will do customized, you know, where do you want to go? We'll help you get there. And also has community engagement and different activities where we can gather people together, teach them how to actually grocery shop on a bike. You know, let's get together and do that.
So are people, when they go out and is this, do you think of it as a habit? Like we were talking about earlier, I mean, this is a habit, whether or not it is, in fact, a factor of necessity or not. It's just, this is what we do. It's a habit. And we're not really thinking about it all that much.
Absolutely. America is, we're car-centric. Our entire country, our infrastructure was built and developed, focused on the single-occupant vehicle. And so that's what we're used to, absolutely. I think that, and have seen over the years, we have a really unique opportunity with air quality. Yes, it's an incredibly, you know, frustrating challenge for residents as well. But the fact that it's visual, it's uniting, and we all, across all boundaries, care passionately about this issue. It's that crisis moment where we can start having that conversation and provide some assistance to start breaking that habit. We have incentives built into the program. A lot of our programs are all about getting people started.
Yeah.
And once they get started, we hear the feedback that, oh, this is really enjoyable. I love getting some physical activity into my
day. Or it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad. Yeah. I took tracks up here and, you know, it's really nice to actually sit and not have to be focused on driving your vehicle and frustrated with that driver next to you.
Are we at a crisis point, Judy? Do you think people think of it, whether we are technically at a crisis point, are people thinking about it that way? I mean, you were at the rally on Saturday. What was the sense you got there about the way people are thinking about it?
Yeah, I do think people feel like it's a crisis right now. And it's a great, I guess you would call it a teachable moment. I thought it was great because I think people see both their personal responsibility and the importance of motivating the government or keeping the government, the lawmakers and the governor motivated towards helping find solutions that will work for everyone. Again, making transit more available. Even the Tier 3, for instance, that's a government regulation, but it's going to help us do the right thing more, even if we don't intend to.
Charles Duhigg was talking earlier about the importance of this. So you need the activists at first to jump in and really sort of stir up the dust and get people, you know, engaged and worried and all those kinds of things. But you have to make that transition to, as he said, normal people, you know, just rank and file people making the change. Kate, how are you thinking about that part of it? Are you getting to people who aren't thinking that much about, you know, environmental activism, or aren't thinking about ditching their car? That wouldn't have even occurred to them, really.
Absolutely. And I think the Smart Trips program is a great example of that. I mean, we target our specific community. Last summer, we were in Fair Park, and the program provides incentives to try and get people interested. Oh, I can get a free transit pass. I'm interested now. Or I can get a bike light, or different things like that. Just a little incentive that gets people that extra interest to engage with us. And then that line of communication is open. All of our materials were targeted to our Fair Park community. So we provided everything in English and in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And really, you know.
Does that work? I mean, I guess the question is, does that really work? I mean, you have, you know, that kind of education level. Or one of the things Duhigg was talking about was peer pressure. Like, how do you impose peer pressure on people, you know, glaring at each other somehow in an idling car, rapping on a door? I mean, does it work? You know, the education, but that's a sort of passive way of doing it. Mm-hmm. But do you think of something else you have to be a little bit more aggressive? I mean, what works and what doesn't? Have you figured it out yet?
Well, Smart Trips, we actually have some really exciting results from the program that our participants, it does work for them. We see an 18% increase in environmentally preferable trips, so taking a trip that's not in a car. And
that's because of education.
So that's all through the different resources and engagement that we've done. It's not a purely education-based program.
Right.
It's taking that extra step. We actually really heavily rely on a model called community-based social marketing, and it's an internationally recognized model to elicit real and sustained behavior change. And it has a very specific methodology laid out, understanding the barriers and benefits.
Yeah, those are the two crucial ones, right?
Exactly.
You got to identify the barriers. You got to identify the benefits. So let me ask you to break that down. What are the barriers and the benefits? Just sort of give me a thumbnail sketch about that you identify for people for this issue of driving.
Absolutely. The barriers can come down to they kind of run the gamut. There's infrastructure barriers, which we're all familiar with. And those are a larger issue. But then there's that newness barrier. I've never done it before, and I don't know where to get started. And that's really what we're hoping to accomplish with this. There's a cost barrier related to transit. And actually, Salt Lake City is very excited as of March 1st for launching our Hive Pass, which is $30 a month for a UTA transit pass for Salt Lake City residents. So we're looking at those barriers. The goal is to remove the barriers to that desired behavior that you would like.
How do you explain the benefit? I mean, I was talking to Charles Duhigg earlier about the idea of how do you identify what is a reward? You can say that clean air is an abstract reward. I mean, right? But how do you say here's your reward for kind of going out of your way, spending a little bit of money, walking a few more blocks than you normally would? I mean, how do you identify the reward, the benefit for them?
The actually really fun thing about these programs is that we hear a lot of benefits, that reward from our participants that we were not even expecting. This sense of I better understand my community now that I have walked to my bus stop and back every day. I've noticed.
Well, I know the neighborhood better.
Yeah, I know the neighborhood better. I meet people. I notice different interesting aspects of my neighborhood. I didn't really ever go to that park that I walked by, but now we go every Saturday. Different things like that that you wouldn't expect. I love my free time. When I'm on tracks, I'm able to check my email or listen to the radio or do different things that, you can't do as actively, especially like texting and things like that are absolutely unsafe in a vehicle. So you hear those kinds of benefits as well. So we actually try to capture those stories through our programs and share them because I think that those stories are really inspiring and have the ability to really impact people and get them also to be motivated to make those changes.
Kate, can you say how the city is trying to make it cool to do these things?
Is that a part of it?
I mean, yeah.
It's got to be, right? I mean, that's a
absolutely.
Part of peer pressure. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually, related to taking transit and our new Hive Pass, it does not look like a typical UTA pass. It's got this really fun graphic image where we're calling it the Hive Pass. It's got, a different feel to it. And I think with all of our outreach, we're trying to have this kind of fresh approach that is, as engaging and approachable as possible. And it is fun, especially I think for the millennial generation. Texting in your car is incredibly dangerous. But if you actually get on the bus, you can text, you can watch a video, you can stream whatever you want. So yeah, our programs definitely are reaching out to that target audience.
Here's an email from Janine who writes, the rally had little to speak about doing our part to prove the air quality. Every individual knows driving a car is the major contributor, but few are willing to walk the talk. Did you get the sense of that, Judy, that a lot of the attention or most of the attention was on industry, on the polluters, and not on driving? This seemed to be Janine's perspective.
You know, I guess I could see how you might see that. I talked to a lot of people, though, who were really excited that they were able to get UTA ran buses up to the rally to help people leave their cars behind so they could use transit. And a lot of people bike there. One of my favorite interviews was talking to four college-age kids from West Valley City. And, you know, they were all they looked really fine. They were out to have a good time, but they'd carpooled. And they were talking about, you know, how their buddies were really interested in showing off their cars. And so it was kind of a hard sell for them. And I said, well, so you guys are trendsetters then? And they're like, yeah. They were pretty
proud.
So
this is the cool thing that you were talking about?
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like there has to be something that people think about their neighbors and their friends. Oh, my friend's doing it. If my friend can do it, I can do it too. So it seems like a big element. So I did see a lot of that out there. But yeah, there was a lot of talk about, you know, the big guys too and what they could do.
Do you see that? Do you wish the equation would shift a little bit, that people would spend more time talking about the driving part than they would talking about, you know, Kennecott or, you know, the refinery? I mean, not that that doesn't have a play a role. Of course it does. Again, we've talked about that. But are you hoping that people spend a little bit more time talking about the individual part?
Yes, yeah. In a short answer. I completely understand why there is such a focus on industry. You know, we've all seen the numbers from DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, that 11% of our air pollution is from industry and over 50% on the typical winter day is from our motor vehicles. You know, it's always easier to look at something else than to look at our habits. But I also understand the argument of, if you're asking me to do something, I want to know what you're doing about that. And that is a valid conversation to have. And there are things that are actively happening with the state implementation plan related to our winter PM2.5 pollution. There is stricter regulation that is coming down on industry. But, you know, I think the conversation does need to be married a bit so people hear the request, but then also what is being requested of business and industry.
Andre writes this. He says, asking people to act or sacrifice in the name of the common environmental good is fundamentally what has pushed environmentalists to be considered extreme. He talks about how the conservatives were able to beat Carter out of office. He mentions Reagan here. After Carter asked the country to sacrifice in the name of including driving less and keeping speeds to 55 miles per hour, that there was this disincentive politically. Are we reaching a tipping point politically, Judy, where even in a fairly conservative culture, it could be regarded as good politically to be talking about this? I mean, is this just a liberal conservative issue? Is that changing? Do you see that yet?
It certainly seems to be. If you look at even the speeches, I think of Patrice Arendt's speech on Saturday.
Democratic lawmaker, we should say.
Democratic lawmaker and one of the leaders of the Clean Air Caucus in the Capitol is talking. Her study of air quality issues was in the Economic Development Committee, the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, which I guess is a partner in the Clear the Air Challenge. Mm-hmm. They have a committee that meets, I think, monthly to talk about air quality. I think that there's a lot of juice behind this interest, and I think it's a lot more widespread. And I think that people really do see a cost to the environment as being a cost to the community and our ability to continue to grow and thrive.
You're starting to hear, I think, these conversations that it's going to start affecting a business's desire to locate here. So you're hearing these economic questions, it seems.
It already has. If you talk to the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, they have stories of businesses visiting, unfortunately, during an inversion. And there was one experience where they said, turn around, take me home. Wow. That they won't consider the area because of air quality. Now, in that conversation, if you can talk about all the active things that are happening to reduce the air pollution in the valley, you know, that's an opportunity to keep that conversation going. But it is impacting the economics of Utah. And I think that that really has a lot of people paying attention.
Been neglecting calls. Let me take a few. Gayla is with us in South Jordan. Hi.
Hi. On all of our conversation, I don't think I've heard one person say we need total emissions throughout the state. We've got about four counties. I think Cash is finally getting on board over there in Logan. But we're such a mobile society. We really need to have it on all of the cars as they travel throughout the state. If you go to the Hill today, you could say, how many of you have emissions control on your cars? Not everybody could raise their hand. Hmm. Those guys have driven over here. They're going to drive their cars around in our valley for 45 days. I know that's a big picture, because then you've got to have these emission control stations. People are going to have to pay for it. But I've also noticed, I think every single week I will see a car with an out-of-state tag that's expired, and I'm wondering, how long has that person been driving in our state with outdated tags? And so he's probably not had anything done with his car.
Yeah. Judy, you want to say anything about that? I mean, I don't know what there is to be said. This is one of those issues that comes up at the legislature from time to time. You know, rural communities, and maybe it's not just rural communities, but they shouldn't have the same kinds of standards that urban ones would.
I hate to sound like a broken record, but I think that's part of the beauty of Tier 3 again, because all of the cars are going to be made cleaner. And if I remember correctly, in the Cache Valley, some USU researchers did some studies a few years back, and I can't remember the exact number, but they basically said that about 5 or 10% of the cars were responsible for most of the pollution. That the newer, cleaner cars weren't a problem. So you could consider a tailpipe tax or something like that, or you just change over the fleet. As everyone buys a new car, they buy a cleaner car.
Thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Kate Lonis, one thing you've said is that it's important to get a kind of a commitment from a participant. And what does that mean? You mentioned signing like an online pledge or something?
Yeah, all of our community engagement programs have that emphasis on getting an actual commitment, whether it's verbal, written, if it's public, even better. The Clear the Air Challenge, I think, is a great example of that, because you sign up online, and once you have committed to these behavior changes, your commitment is public. You are up on the website, and not only are you there, people can see what you've done or not done to date. And the team model actually is also a great example of that. Social norming. If someone's not pulling their weight on the team, they'll start to feel that pressure to pull their weight. So those commitments, I think the Idle Free decals you see around are another great example of that. It's visual, it's out there, it's a reminder to the participant that they've made this commitment. And with community-based social marketing, it has been shown to have a much larger return on actually following through.
Maybe it's too early to ask this question, but I wonder, Judy, what do you think we'll see during the legislative session related to air quality or lawmakers responding?
Well, frankly, I think that the biggest issue is going to be money, and how the legislature actually funds the stepped-up enforcement, which would, for instance, help with the INM and making sure people aren't burning wood when they're not supposed to, that sort of thing. Also the clean bus program that they're developing. That's money intensive, and the legislature has not been really interested in spending a lot of money on environmental issues in the past. So that's going to be the big driver. I think one of the messages in the rally the other day was we really need to press legislators to fund these programs, because they need to be out there. They need to realize that they're important to us. So I think that, again, that's going to be a nail biter, because they normally don't wrap up the budget until the very end of the session. But it sounds like people are contacting their lawmakers, so it is on the top of the agenda now.
That's the question, I guess, Kate. Is that part of the education process? Is talk to your lawmakers? Is that something you've focused on? And what kind of help do you need from lawmakers?
Mayor Becker gave his State of the City address, and it was completely focused on air quality. He decided that that is the most pressing issue for our city and focused his address on that, and had some very specific requests from the state, including raising the local option sales tax to better fund public transit. That's a cap that Salt Lake City has reached, and our hands are tied at this point in terms of increasing our funding locally. Tier 3, as Judy's been talking about, is another ask of the state. And changing the state law to have local Utah-specific solutions. So our hands are not tied to what the federal government has set as their standard.
He's doing all this asking. What's the response? Yeah. How are you feeling optimistic about all of that, I guess, is the question.
The wonderful thing is that there are several bills already that have been presented by this Clean Air Caucus. There's one related to Tier 3. There is one related to the local option sales tax. We are seeing legislation in the works. I mean, it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Because the money thing, Judy, right?
Yes.
That's going to be the obstacle, right?
I don't know if it's going to be an obstacle, but I think it's definitely the issue to watch.
And I think that it's been so interesting in the coverage that we've seen recently, the power of people actually contacting their legislators, that they listen.
Let me ask you this finally. Are we at a tipping point on an issue like this? Is that hard to say?
It sure seems like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I would absolutely agree. When Salt Lake City pulled together stakeholders for an air quality partners team 5 years ago now, the stakeholders had never been in the room together. And from that point, over the past 5 years, so many different groups have formed, and organizations like the Chamber have gotten involved, that the landscape is completely different. And all of these voices are incredibly important in that conversation.
That's Kate Lonas. She is Communications Manager for Salt Lake City's Division of Sustainability and Environment. Judy Faze, of course, a reporter here at KUER. She covers the environment. We'll check in with you again, see what's going on the Capitol. We're hoping to hear from those of you. Go to our website. You can continue the conversation, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Allman, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Eileen Clark. And let me just say, to Kate and Judy, thank you, by the way. Didn't say that.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
I'm Doug Fabrizio.